is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeyis Wahib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, state of emergency and curfew imposed by the military in Sudan. Political violence is continuing in some parts of South Africa. And services have returned in Nigeria after an attack took place on a rail line connecting the capital Abuja. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The leader of Sudan's interim ruling council declared today he has imposed a state of emergency and curfew, dissolved the government, arrested the prime minister and the top leaders, and suspended several key articles of the transitional constitution. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said in a nationally televised address he was acting due to political infighting, saying it has created divisions that threaten national security, unity and public safety. He vowed to stick with national elections planned for July 2023 and uphold international agreements signed since the ouster of longtime leader Omar al-Bashir in 2019. He said, however, he was dissolving the Sovereignty Council that has been running the country and the Council of Ministers, relieving all of the ministers, state governors and ministry undersecretaries. Burhan's takeover followed a visit by Jeffrey Feltman, the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa. A State Department spokesman said Feltman was en route back to Washington but is holding in Doha given developments. It was unclear how the military action will affect the country's path to democracy after former Bashir was ousted in a popular uprising. Most telecommunications in Khartoum have shut down, including the internet and radio stations. Only a state-owned television station was on the air, broadcasting patriotic music. VOA's Joe Tanza spoke with reporter Michael Atit on how the events have unfolded.
And Michael, who is arresting these people? It appears like this is a huge number of politicians who have been taken. Who is arresting them?
Of course, the arrest is being carried out by the Sudanese military and security forces. The executive director of in the office of the prime minister, he says men came in military uniform and arrested Hamdok and his wife and have taken them to an unknown location. So if you look at the town outside, seems there is a heavy deployment of security forces along the road and at the main government ministries and institutions, you will definitely conclude that the arrest is being carried out by the military, who are the component of the Sudanese transitional government. And thousands of Sudanese actually are now moving to the streets within the main roads and neighborhoods, protesting against the move by the military, and actually some of them are raising a slogan that this is a coup actually against the transitional government in Sudan.
And what about the national broadcaster, the Sudan Television? What are you seeing on the national broadcaster? What kind of statements or announcements are being aired?
There was a confirmed information that there is a heavy deployment of military there. And there are also information about some of the employers there have been arrested and also taken to unknown location. As we speak, all the radio stations operating within Khartoum are off air. So the only media outlet that is operating currently, it is the Sudan Television, which they are also broadcasting some of the Patriots' songs.
What you are describing here is a semblance of a military takeover. From your vantage point or from where you are sitting now, what are you seeing through the windows?
I'm speaking from Khartoum South, where thousands of young people, men and women, actually are currently on the streets, are gathering in every junction, and some of them are moving towards the town. And some shops where I am, some shops are open and some bakeries are open, but there are a few movement of vehicles on the road, and there are a few shops that are also closed because at this situation, some business might, you know, fear their business to be maybe looted or just in any case. So some shops are closed, but some remain open, you know, and there are a few also people going for some shopping. Since the situation is going to this direction, you know, there might be the situation might worsen a little bit. So some people are going for grocery shopping, some dry stuff of that kind.
That was VOA's Jad Tanza speaking with reporter Michael Atit from Sudan. The developments sparked swift condemnation from the United Nations, U.S. Embassy and African Union. UN Secretary Antonio Guterres called the takeover an attempt to undermine Sudan's political transition, and he urged the immediate release of detained officials, saying their arrests are unacceptable. He also urged all parties to immediately return to dialogue and engage in good faith to restore the constitutional order. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet said it would be disastrous if Sudan goes backwards after finally bringing an end to decades of repressive dictatorship. In the run-up to the COP26 UN climate talks, seven organizations based in Africa have been named finalists for the annual Ashton Awards given to low-carbon pioneers globally for their contribution in creating resilience, green growth, and fairer societies. The winners will be announced at the COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, in November. Dismas Kisulu is the founder and chief executive of Solar Freeze, a social enterprise that offers pay-as-you-store refrigeration in humanitarian settings in Kenya's semi-arid northern region, including the Kakuma refugee camp. Reporter Ruben Chama asked him what such global recognition means for organizations working in Africa.
We are excited about the global recognition because it puts a spotlight on what Solar Freeze is doing to provide refrigeration and cooling to off-grid communities. We are excited about it because we are providing a solution to communities that need it, not only in Kenya, but across Africa. If they need access to cooling for vaccines, medicine, and perishable produce, this award puts a spotlight on our work, and we are excited about it. Solar Freeze was started in 2016 to provide access to refrigeration and cooling to off-grid communities, whereby our main product is solar-powered refrigeration as a service. Currently, we are working in Kenya, and our main product is in northeastern Kenya as well as eastern Kenya, whereby we have access to refrigeration and cooling as a service, where communities pay as little as 0.01 cents per day to access our cold storage system.
What are some of the key actions that communities like the ones you work with in northern Kenya and nations such as Kenya can take to reduce the harm from climate change?
Where communities can take their money next to their communities. So, for example, people should be focused on where their produce is coming from. They should focus on local production and local consumption, so promote local farmers so that the carbon footprint is reduced. Focus on local grassroots farmers and promote them.
We know the cause. We know wealthy nations aren't really going to address the needs of developing economies. So what can communities, non-profit organizations, and businesses, as well as governments, do in their own countries to help citizens?
I think the most relevant action is to work with grassroots organizations such as Solar Freeze, whereby they work with organizations that are working with communities. It's easier to create an impact instead of parachuting an impact from abroad. Because community already knows their problem, local organizations can work to enhance those solutions. So that's why I think governments, NGOs, and the private sector should work with grassroots organizations.
What are some of the steps that governments and individual citizens themselves need to take to mitigate the effects of climate change?
The most relevant step for government and individuals is to promote local production and local consumption, whereby if countries are self-sustainable, they can create their own source of produce. For example, Solar Freeze is working with local farmers because we think that we are providing a solution to preserve produce and preserve medications. If this value chain is within countries and governments and organizations support it as well as individuals, I think we can scale this further.
Finally, what is your call for world leaders and communities as they gather for this year's climate change summit in Glasgow later this month?
My call for world leaders as well as communities is that we only have a few years to make the world better. And if we do not, there's no turning back. So let's make it now or never. Let's make the change now.
That was Dismas Kisulu, founder and chief executive of Solar Freeze, a finalist for the annual Ashton Awards, speaking with reporter Ruben Chama from Nairobi. Political violence is continuing in some parts of South Africa, especially KwaZulu-Natal province, ahead of local government elections next Monday. There's tension in certain areas, with some political analysts predicting big losses for the ruling African National Congress, especially in urban centers where the ANC's support's been slipping steadily since the early 2000s. Darren Taylor reports.
Last month, when ANC supporters in Inanda, near the city of Durban, were nominating candidates for the upcoming elections, gunmen opened fire, killing three women. Police suspect the killers were hired by an ANC official, angry at being excluded from the nomination process. This motive has, however, been downplayed by ANC KwaZulu-Natal representative Nhlakanipho Ntombela.
It's a pure criminality. What happened in Inanda, those were ordinary supporters of the ANC, old women, coming to cast their vote for the preferred candidate. And then a car came by, a drive-by shooting. Clearly, it's pure criminality of those individuals.
But political analysts say the only thing that's clear is that the ANC doesn't want to acknowledge, at least publicly, that it's in such chaos leading up to the elections that its members are killing one another. In KwaZulu-Natal and elsewhere, it's all about the power that goes along with winning a seat in local councils. Power that gives councillors the authority to award multi-million rand tenders to individuals and companies that pay them kickbacks, says Democratic Alliance spokesman Zwakhele Mqwango.
Tender system is the cause of political murderers. Most of the recent killings, it's all about resources and mainly in municipalities. It's rare you hear member of parliament being killed. It's mainly councillors, because that's where politicians are close to resources. So the issue here is about the fight of resources in municipalities.
In 2016, the ANC appointed a commission of inquiry into political killings in KwaZulu-Natal and reached the same conclusion. A judge's report recommended wide-ranging changes to policies in municipalities that would severely curtail councillors' powers in making decisions around service delivery tenders. The government never implemented the recommendations, and the corruption and killings have continued. Senior Inkatha Freedom Party official Joshua Mazibuko says the violence linked to electioneering isn't stopping because the police are failing to arrest suspects.
That gives the community, relatives and those who love the one who's died, they tend to now think that they must take the law into their own hands. They have perceptions of who might be responsible. So in that sense, government fails us.
Political analyst Sipho Siepe says South Africans, even if they belong to the same political party, usually try to solve problems with violence.
Even in a sports field, something that is supposed to bring joy among contestants and all the fans, you will sometimes end up with tensions that will lead to killings. The language that we use, we insult each other, as it happens in politics. That's not a language of inviting for a dialogue. They express themselves in a language of violence and end up in violence.
He says the current political violence, mostly within the ANC, is a reflection of a sick society.
Take the lockdowns. As soon as we thought about lockdowns, the immediate reaction was bring the defense force, bring the police. So our approach has always been around brute force.
The latest victim of the political strife in KwaZulu-Natal is a councillor candidate from the Economic Freedom Fighters Party. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. Political violence is continuing in some parts of South Africa. State of emergency and curfew imposed by the military in Sudan. And services have returned in Nigeria after an attack took place in a rail line connecting the capital Abuja. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. In Nigeria, service has resumed on a train line that was bombed last Wednesday evening. No one was harmed in the assault. The attack took place on the rail line connecting the capital Abuja with the northern town of Kaduna. Some in the media say that terrorists and not ordinary bandits were also involved in the incident. Authorities have not yet commented on the allegation. From Abuja, Munachi Chooks has this report.
With poor maintenance and bandit attacks, many Nigerian travelers have turned to air and rail for intercity trips. But the attack between the relatively safe Regina and Duse train stops outside Kaduna is setting off alarm bells within security agencies as assaults get closer to the country's capital. This is not the first bandit attack on a passenger train, but was the first to have forced the Nigeria Railway Corporation to suspend its services. Mohammed Garuba, a journalist in Kaduna State who was on the Abuja-Kaduna train, spoke to VOA about his experience.
We arrived, it makes us to arrive around 2 a.m. in the night. Instead of a journey of 2 hours, 6 to 8:30, it took us up to 6 hours. Actually, we didn't feel anything when we heard of the blast. We actually thought it was one of the engines, rather the locomotive that has the problem. So we were calm, not until after 2, 3, 4 hours, then we realized that something is wrong.
Some media accounts say the bandits planned not just to rob passengers, but to kidnap them and ask for ransom. Others say the attack was a joint effort by bandits and the Boko Haram terrorist group. The government has not commented on the allegations. But security expert Jackson Ojo suspects a terrorist link to the incident.
I know Nigeria government will want to look for a way to defend the situation in order to stop any criticism from the angle of security. These people came. They destroyed that in through explosive in order to stop the train so that they can attack. And these are not even work of bandits. These are real work of the terrorist.
In Nigeria, bomb attacks against rail lines are rare. But some officials say they are nevertheless at risk of assaults by local bandits. Olawale Rashid is the chairman of African Railway Consult Limited.
The incident at Abuja Kaduna train is a normal event within the railway system. You know, the railway system normally pass through deserted lands, and one way or the other you have vandals and third-party intrusions that normally affect the railway system.
Rashid says that acquiring new train technologies will help protect trains from future attacks.
I will recommend technology surveillance. I will also recommend a bit of more human policing of some major areas, of especially the all spots. So I think overall, this is a new development, and I think Nigeria is up to the task.
Within days of the attack, Nigeria's Minister for Transport traveled to the site to inspect damage and repairs to the line and approved the resumption of the Abuja-Kaduna rail services, which started again on Saturday. A government investigation into the incident is ongoing. Authorities say they are ready to improve security along all rail corridors and that the government will approve the installation of a digital security system to address future challenges. For VOA News, Munachi Chuks.
Malawi's government has started a campaign to remove children from places like nightclubs where they are being forced or tricked into prostitution. But rights activists say the campaign is targeting the wrong people because it does not target the perpetrators. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
At the start of the campaign Wednesday, government authorities, with help from police, conducted daytime raids on lodges, clubs and bars in the capital, Lilongwe. The operation rescued 10 children between the ages of 14 to 16 who were being forced or lured into prostitution. The authorities say they plan to put the girls into rehabilitation centers before they are sent back to their homes. Patricia Galiat is the Minister of Social Welfare. She says the campaign is part of the government's policy to protect children against all forms of exploitation.
And we've been talking about the sexual harassment, and even having a number of organizations are talking about the same sexual harassment programs and the policies which we have. So it's really very sad that some people are doing business out of some other's children.
One of the rescued girls says she was deceived by someone to come to Lilongwe for domestic work, but was eventually forced into commercial sex work. She says the proceeds of her work were surrendered to her purported master, who is still at large. Victor Muhango is executive director for Center for Human Rights Education, Advice and Assistance. He commends the campaign, but says the problem is that the real culprits are left unpunished.
These children that are being employed by people, other people, are adults. Maybe they are used as pimps. So they collect money from clients, if they sleep with clients, and then they get the money themselves and give something to the children. So to us, that is a crime.
Human rights lawyer Ruth Kaima points out that prostitution is legal in Malawi.
For these minors, them engaging in sex work on their own, they are not committing an offense, but it's illegal because you're not supposed to harbor minors and engage them in sex work, because you're exploiting them and you're also abusing them.
However, Gariati says the Red Wednesday serves as a warning about the impending punishment for those who push minors into prostitution.
We close all those, our list houses, sorry, who are keeping these toddlers, because they know that we need to protect our children and we need to safeguard our children. And we need also to respect the rights of our children, that they could live peacefully without even being harassed sexually.
However, rights campaigners say the sexual exploitation of children in Malawi will only end if underlying factors like poverty are addressed. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Straight Talk Africa. We're looking at the impact of COVID-19 restrictions on air travel across the continent. As countries open their skies again and travelers board planes, where do African countries stand on vaccine passports? Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. This Wednesday